The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For those of you who I haven't met, my name is Andrea, and I teach here. I'm the regular teacher on Thursday nights, although I also teach a lot of retreats, so I'm here and gone, and I will be gone next week. But in any case, last week when I was here at the end of the talk, I didn't have any time for questions, and so I said, this week would be a question time. I haven't done this in a while. I haven't opened it up to just an evening of questions. And one of the ways I like to do this, the way I think I'll try it tonight again, is to take several questions from the room, and I'll write them down, and then I'll kind of try to weave them together into a kind of a talk. The last time I did this, I think I took 8 questions and only managed to answer 4. So tonight I'll take 4 questions. And if there's time at the end, I'll see if what I've said has generated more questions. So any questions? Questions about practice, questions about concepts, ideas, anything you've heard here, anything at all, questions.
Hello. My question is about, I'm new to here, but my question has to do about Monday, so maybe you can help me with this, if you don't mind. Maybe yes, maybe no, but there was a speaker who was talking about his story coming out of prison, and I didn't think of my question at the time, so I can't ask him. But he was talking, and I'm not sure what words he used. He was talking about his enormous peace in every smallest moment of a second that he just felt so wonderful or something. And I was touched by how he said that, yet he also was so emotionally tearful when he talked about. And I'm thinking what I saw was just this immense compassion for himself in all suffering, mm-hmm. and how this wonderful peace can be that. And I thought that was very interesting, and I saw that, I witnessed that, and I just didn't know that was, if you could speak to that.
Okay, so let me just see if I can restate it a little bit. So the question is about the ease and peace that can come even when there is a sense of emotion or a sense of one's own struggle, that there can be ease and peace within that, and to just speak to that. To that? Okay, I can do that. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
So my question has to do with, does meditation leading to an escape attitude? I mean, escape means like avoiding unpleasant things in life. If people do develop an escape attitude because of meditation, it's because people don't meditate right, or meditation bring out a different problem. I don't know.
Okay, thank you. Over here.
I think last week you talked about the 3 kinds of dukkha. I'd be curious what the techniques are for sort of getting yourself to cope or eliminate those 3 kinds, and are the techniques different for each of the 3, or the same technique for all 3?
Okay. That actually might be enough to start with. So I can start there. And then we'll see if this generates any more questions. So I think I see kind of a flow through these in reverse order. So I'll start with the third question. So last week I talked about struggle, suffering, the term dukkha, the Pali term dukkha, often translated as suffering, could be translated as struggle, unease, dissatisfaction, distress, stress, a variety of terms that this term dukkha refers to. And this is a key concept in what the Buddha explored and understood, that his whole search of how to, his whole search for freedom was motivated by contacting dukkha, contacting struggle, suffering, stress, and seeing, is there a way to be free of this? Is there a way to be free of this struggle in our lives? That he looked out at the world and saw so many people suffering and trying to find happiness in ways that seemed to just lead them right back into more suffering. And so he asked the question, is there a way to get off of this cycle or this wheel that of ways that we struggle and suffer? And in this exploration, he enumerated kind of three levels of this suffering. And so the suffering, the word suffering, often we think of as really big suffering. You know, it's the major disasters of our life, or made like the hurricanes and the tsunamis and the diagnosis of cancer and car accidents. This is what we put on the term suffering. But the term dukkha actually means many subtler things than that. And so the Buddha enumerated three different levels of suffering, of dukkha. And just very briefly, I'll enumerate them again. The first one is the suffering that's due to pain or unpleasant experience, where pain, again, may be a little bit strong of a word here, but suffering due to experiencing unpleasant things. And this, there's a range of this as well, that there's the unpleasantness of being in a car accident, which is pretty extreme. And then there's the unpleasantness of having an itch, which is pretty mild. But in any case, the suffering around this, the dukkha around this, isn't the unpleasantness of broken bones or the unpleasantness of an itch itself. Rather, it's the way that we react, the way that we react to this unpleasantness. That the unpleasantness itself, what the Buddha actually discovered, is that the unpleasantness itself is simply unpleasant, and all of the reactivity that we layer on top of that is where our struggle is really found. That if you could imagine, and we'll take the itch now for an example, if you could imagine having an itch where you were absolutely fine with it, no problem to have an itch, would there be any suffering around the itch? There might be a little bit of unpleasant physical experience, but would there really be a problem if there was absolutely no reactivity to an itch? And so this is what the Buddha is pointing to by dukkha. It's the way that we react to our experience. And so the first level of dukkha is the ways that we react around unpleasant experience. And this tends to be the kind of suffering that is really obvious to us. You know, we tend to react to unpleasant experience with aversion. We push it away. And that aversion has many flavors, anger, frustration, irritation, annoyance, hostility, rage, cruelty, all kinds of flavors of that that reactivity to unpleasant. And again, if we didn't have reactivity to unpleasant experience, it would be more just navigating our life, recognizing there's some things that are pleasant, some things that are unpleasant, and kind of flowing with it as opposed to fighting. So it's the kind of the way we fight life that the Buddha was talking about with respect to dukkha. So that's the first level of dukkha, the dukkha of unpleasant experience. Working with that level, so first, as I go through each of these, I think I'll talk to address your question, which is, how do we work with this? How do we explore this? And the question phrased in how do we eliminate these, the way towards eliminating, and maybe I could use the word letting go, of the reactivity to unpleasant sensation. The first way to do that, the first exploration that we make, is to, can we be completely okay with the reactivity? That, you know, there's what seems to happen with unpleasant experience and our reactivity to it is that the reactivity compounds itself. So it's not simply an itch and, you know, being a little bit frustrated by the itch. If we don't do something about that, if for some reason, you know, we're driving a car and we really have to keep our eyes on the road and we've got this itch and we cannot take our hands off the wheel, that may be a little bit of a stretch of an example, but there's some reason why you cannot scratch the itch. You know, the mind can get wrapped up around it. It reacts to its reactions. It gets frustrated, and then it gets frustrated by the frustration, and then perhaps angry by the frustration, and then irritated by the anger. And so there's a kind of a layering on of reactivity that happens. And so the first approach is to just meet our experience wherever we are with this reactivity. This is what it feels like to be frustrated. So we meet that reactivity and begin to notice, are we reacting to the reactivity? And again, also try to meet that. Turning to meet that, the best way that I know to do that, the best technique that I know to do that, is to meet the reactivity in the body, to see, begin to get familiar with, what does it feel like to be a human being that feels frustrated? What does it feel like to be a human being that feels angry? So that we get familiar with the physicality of those difficult experiences. And as we begin to get familiar with that, we may begin to get to the place where we can actually notice the itch, notice the unpleasantness, notice that actual unpleasant experience, and then begin to see that times we can just be with that unpleasantness. Oh, there's just an itch, and boy, that's unpleasant. And then we might start to see the beginning of reactivity to that unpleasantness. And as we see the beginning of that reactivity, we begin to understand how our minds... One of the things we start to see there is when we have an unpleasant experience that which we are not reacting to, we see how the mind is at ease, more at ease around that experience. And then as we start to see a reaction beginning, we see directly for ourselves how our own minds add to our suffering. So the Buddha talked about this as being like a second arrow. He said the first arrow, the unpleasant sensation, that's like a dart hitting us, an arrow hitting us. There's an unpleasantness of that arrow striking us. And then the reactivity that we have to that is like we're hitting ourselves with a second arrow, a third arrow, a fourth arrow, a fifth arrow. And it compounds the unpleasantness of that first experience. And so as we start to watch the reactivity, begin to be able to be with the reactivity, we begin to see some of those layers of reactivity, of unpleasantness fall away. We see the mind can be more at ease with this unpleasant experience. Just be more at ease with that unpleasant experience. And if all the reactivity falls away and you're just with the unpleasant experience, you see, oh, it's no problem. It's just an unpleasant experience. And so we start to directly understand through this process how our own minds contribute to our suffering. So we begin to understand what the Buddha was talking about. We begin to understand how our mental reactivity is where we suffer. So that's the first level of dukkha, and for myself, turning towards the reactivity, turning into the body, getting familiar with the bodily experience of emotions, and this can take some time for people, especially beginners. I know when I started meditation, it's like the body, you know, feelings in the body, you know, what does that mean? You know, it was kind of hard to begin to get a sense of what it meant to feel an emotion in the body. But just beginning to just explore that possibility over time, I began to understand, you know, anger feels like pressure and heat building, and fear has a sense of vibration or fluttering, perhaps, around the area of the stomach, contraction in the throat. So just beginning to get familiar with how the body is around these difficult emotions. So that's the first area, exploring the body. And then also starting to get, as we can, approach what is it that we're actually reacting to? You know, so we have this, sometimes we end up with this whole stream of reactivity in our minds that was, you know, reacting to something, and we're not really sure what we're reacting to. You know, we know that we're feeling upset about something, or we're angry about something, or we're feeling aversive about something, and we're not really sure what's going on, you know, why that is. So an exploration around what is it that I'm actually reacting to can be interesting. How, you know, what's going on? What am I actually reacting to? You know, I was doing some walking meditation on one retreat, and I was noticing that the mind was just generally aversive. It was averse to the shoes at the end of the path. You know, somebody's shoes sitting down at the end of the path, and it's like, well, obviously it's not really the shoes I'm reacting to. You know, something else is going on here. And I can't remember what it was at that point. But you know, some other things are going on. Maybe it was a hunger. You know, actually that's something I noticed for myself a lot, that when I get hungry, the unpleasantness of hungry puts me into a generally aversive state. And so if I can just tune in and recognize, okay, you know, it's not really you I'm mad at. It's this feeling of hunger that is making me feel irritated that is triggering this whole cascade of reactivity. So starting to see if we can tune into what it is that we're reacting to. And then when we can find that thing, you know, what is it that's actually that we're reacting to, can we tune in and notice, oh, there's unpleasantness there. When we can actually tune in to notice, oh, unpleasantness is there, it can help to short-circuit our movement to react to it. It's like, oh yeah, that itch is unpleasant. Okay, I can be with that unpleasant itch for a short time, and then maybe the mind goes off and reacts, and then we get to see how the reactivity compounds the frustration and the unpleasantness of the itch. It's very interesting to watch how, as we explore this kind of dukkha, how much our mental reactivity exacerbates our unpleasant experience, and that as we see that reactivity let go, we realize, oh, I can be with this unpleasantness. So most of what we are struggling and suffering around is our own mental machinations. And this is good news, because if it weren't that way, I mean, if it were something in the environment that was actually creating our suffering, we wouldn't have any control over it. But because it's something happening in our own minds, there's a way that we can begin to shift our relationship to our experience. So that's the first kind, looking at the three kinds of suffering. The first kind of suffering due to pain, sometimes called dukkha-dukkha. That's the Pali for that one. So the second kind, the second kind is called suffering due to change. And this is the suffering that arises because it's not suffering. I mean, it's suffering that arises. It's kind of inherent in the nature of experience that if there's something happening that we like, we appreciate, we enjoy, so there's pleasant experience. You know, in the moment, it doesn't seem like there's any suffering or struggle there, and there may not be. If there's any kind of holding on to that pleasant experience, any kind of attachment to it, any kind of identification with it, any sense that, yes, this is the way it's supposed to be, or I finally figured it out, or something along those lines, you know, that there's a sense that this is right, this is the way it's supposed to be, I've got this thing, it's mine. the law or reality of impermanence will at some point take hold, come to fruition. And that pleasant experience, that sense of having something that's mine, that sense of being in control, having figured it out, will change. And we will suffer when that happens. So this suffering due to change, is, we could kind of look at it as the suffering that's hidden in pleasant experience. It's only hidden in it's not inherent in pleasant experience. Pleasant experience is going to come. It's going to be part of life, just like unpleasant experience is going to be part of life. There's this endless stream that we are living in of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience. And we can't stop that stream. It's just a flow of experience. The mind doesn't tend to like this fact of impermanence. It doesn't tend to like this flow, and it tries to stop the flow. It creates these little dams. It's like, oh, I like this arrangement. I want to stop the flow here so that it's like this. I want to, you know, get rid of this part and pull this part in. And so we come up with a configuration that feels good for a little while. And it's only a little while because it changes. And so if we are doing that, stopping and damming and trying to control and hold on to pleasant, to get rid of unpleasant, you know, create an environment that we like. If we're doing that, then we will suffer when things change, as they inevitably will. So it's not the pleasant itself that's a problem. It's not having pleasurable experience that's an issue here. It's the fact that we want to hold on to that pleasant experience. We want to control our experience so that we only have certain experiences and not others. So that that is the suffering due to change. Sometimes it's described as rope burn, that if you think about you know, trying to hold on to something, you know, trying to hold on to a rope that's sliding through your hands, and you don't want that rope to stop, right? You know, it's like you want that rope to stop. You don't want it to slip away. So you're holding on to that as tight as you can. But the inevitability of that rope slipping away is going to burn your hands with rope burn. That's kind of like what happens with trying to hold on to pleasant experience. And so the exploration here, it's a couple of aspects. One is to notice when and this will actually lead into, when I'm back the next time, I'll talk a little bit more about the second noble truth, the truth of wanting, which is this kind of suffering is intimately connected with wanting pleasant experience to stay. And that we find ourselves in a situation where we try to shore ourselves up and we want it to stay that way. And so the wanting is actually the issue in this kind of suffering. You know, it's not so much that you're having pleasant experience, it's the holding to. It's that grabbing onto. And the wanting is the engine that drives that grabbing on. So the first thing to recognize is when you're in a situation where there's a lot of pleasant experience, start to notice, first of all, is there a sense of identification or kind of a shoring yourself up, saying, yep, it's right, this is good, this is the way it's supposed to be? Are you telling yourself a story around the fact that you've managed to create this situation where things are the way you like them for now? So are you telling yourself that? So if there's some kind of a shoring yourself up around that, there's probably a clinging, a holding to that. So beginning to notice that, just recognize. And sometimes that's about all that we can do, is just recognize, okay, yep, I'm holding on to this. I know at times in my meditation practice, I could see that I was holding on to something and see that it was headed me in the direction of suffering, but I had no idea how to let go of it. You know, it's just, and when that happens, it's like, we just, can we be with that recognition of, yep, I'm holding on to this. That's what's happening right now. So ultimately, I mean, in terms of talking about these three different kinds of suffering and ways to work with them, it almost always, I think, maybe I could even say always, comes back to, can you be with what is actually happening right now? That's the ultimate technique in all of these situations. Can you actually be with what is happening right now? Notice, there's pleasant experience happening. There's a situation that I like, and I want it to stay here. Notice that wanting. Notice that experience. Sometimes when we are in our situation around pleasant experience, we're focused on the pleasantness itself. We're focused on the fact that this is the way we like it. This means that I'm doing well. It means I'm a good person. Whatever story we tell ourselves around this, and we're not so much focused on that holding on to or that wanting itself. We don't even notice that sometimes, that sense of needing somehow to kind of keep yourself together or keep the situation together. Sometimes when we have a pleasant experience, there may be a subtle anxiety or a full-blown fear about, well, what happens if this changes? Because somewhere deep inside we know the law of impermanence is going to take hold. And so there's you know, a little bit can be some anxiety. It's like, okay, well, I've got it figured out for now, but how long is this going to last? And how much do I have to do to keep things all shored up? And it's like, you know, fixing the levees. You know, it's like, you know, the story of the little boy with the fingers in the dike, you know, trying to stop up the holes in the dike. So there's that kind of anxiety that can kind of be very subtle underneath around the pleasant experience. And so, again, we're asked to turn towards, what is the actual experience in this moment? I've created a situation, there's been something that I've tried to strive to create, to hold on to. What is actually going on here? Yes, there's the pleasantness of the having, and there may also be some other experiences happening, some anxiety or fear, that wanting itself, just that wanting. So beginning to notice those. As we begin to notice those, we see that having what we want isn't all it's cracked up to be. It puts us in a such situation where we're essentially, you know, we have this notion that if I just can get what I want, you know, if I just can endlessly figure out how to keep a step ahead of the impermanence, that would be happiness. You know, if I can, okay, just as this is falling apart, I can figure out how to put it together again, you know. And what this does for us, actually, is it keeps us on this cycle of wanting. It keeps propelling us forward on this cycle of wanting. And I just heard this very interesting, right? I think I read it, actually, in recent Scientific American, that they've discovered... you know, there's some old studies about the pleasure centers in the brain, where they put electrodes in rats' brains and found that, you know, in certain positions in the brains, the rats would like just sit there and endlessly push this lever to stimulate this place in the brain. And the idea was that this was a pleasure center, that this was a place that made the rat feel so good that it would keep pressing that bar to stimulate that electrode. But what they've actually discovered is that it's more of a wanting center than a pleasure center. And they've actually discovered that the wanting creates its own, like, loop, that the wanting somehow needs to be satisfied, and then there's more wanting that follows on from that, because that satisfaction of that wanting, that ending of that wanting, is really what's going on. Not so much that there's pleasure that's come, main pleasure, I think, coming from the ending of the wanting. And they've actually discovered that in that, it's a little odd, I'm not quite sure how they discovered this, but they discovered that actually in that process of endlessly pushing that lever, the rat was not actually experiencing pleasure. But it was just that wanting cycle, that the wanting was just being reinforced, and that you can continue to want something even when there is no pleasure involved. So this wanting, this I think the Buddha really recognized this craving engine that we operate with. I mean, we think that we're serving ourselves by trying to get what we want, but what we're actually doing is reinforcing wanting, which is not actually a very pleasant experience. And so we're... this is the exploration around the second kind of dukkha. Can we turn towards the wanting? Notice when we are wanting. Allow the wanting, not try to stop it, not try to change it, but again, to kind of be with it. This movement of turning towards and being with, I sometimes use an analogy about this as being... putting a car into neutral, you know, that sometimes I thought about, okay, turning to be with something, isn't that just reinforcing it? But we can turn and with mindfulness allow something that's happening, and it doesn't seem to keep pressing that button. It's like it allows us to take a step back from that cycle of the wanting so that we're not reinforcing it, but we are instead allowing it to end naturally. So that when the wanting ends naturally, when the wanting simply fades, because it does, it's an impermanent phenomenon, when the wanting ends naturally, it doesn't seem to reinforce the next cycle of wanting. When the wanting ends because we've gotten what we want, it reinforces the wanting. So a big exploration here is around noticing what does wanting feel like, turning towards that. And so the exploration of that, very much like putting a car into neutral. So if a car's going really fast down the freeway, you know, when we put the car into neutral, it doesn't stop immediately. The momentum of that car is going to carry it for a while, but it will eventually slow down because we're no longer giving it the engine, giving it the energy. So the wanting is kind of like that. When we bring mindfulness to it, it's like putting our minds into neutral. We've disengaged ourselves from the reinforcement cycle of the wanting, and we're just allowing the gear of wanting to spin down naturally. So this is a very powerful practice around the second kind of dukkha, to observe the wanting, begin to get familiar with the wanting that is in this cycle around the dukkha of change. The third kind of dukkha, the dukkha of existence. You know, this is kind of the subtlest levels of suffering, the subtlest kinds of unease, the kinds of unease that I think I said last week, I think of this as the Buddhist version of existential anxiety. It's that sense of, is this all there is? You know, here living this life, going to work, getting a paycheck to buy food so that I can go to work. And it's just like, you know, I do this over and over and over until I die. That's all that's happening. That exploration, some of the commentaries, some of the Buddhist texts say that this is a kind of response to neutral experience. I talked earlier about there being pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience that's just an endless flow of experience. These three kinds of dukkha can be looked at as reactions to those three kinds of experiences. The feeling tone of experience. Every single experience that we have has either a pleasant, an unpleasant, or a neutral feeling tone to it. And we react to the unpleasantness with this first kind of dukkha. We react to the pleasantness with this second kind of dukkha, trying to hold on, to keep, to try to stem the tide of impermanence, to stop that flow. And then this third kind is more about our reaction to our response to neutral experience. That when we... come to this place of seeing that there's an awful lot of neutrality going on in our lives, We don't tend to like that very much. It feels like meaningless, or it feels like, you know, what's the point? So we have this reactivity to the neutral. And so again, the exploration of this is noticing how we respond when we're having the subtlest kind of suffering. The Buddha pointed to begin to get familiar with all of these different kinds of suffering. And so the subtlest kind of suffering, the suffering of just things feel off right now, turn towards that feeling. Don't repress it. Just don't try to do something to get rid of it. That's, I think, one of the biggest things with this third kind of dukkha. It's so easy with this third kind of dukkha, this niggling sense of, is this all there is, to jump into, oh, well, let me go make a good meal, or let me go fix this problem, so that we are essentially avoiding facing this kind of suffering. And again, the Buddha suggested that turning to face our suffering is the way through it. So to begin to notice when we're having this kind of sense of, yeah, is this all there is? The kind of the existential despair that we can sometimes get into. It's a threatening feeling. We don't like to go there. If we can be with that, this is a place where we need to take care. You know, it can be for some people that this kind of dukkha leads into depression and despair. And so to take care with that, you know, notice for yourself whether it's possible for you to meet this. Gently meet this feeling of, what's the point? And if it feels like you're being pulled into a place of despair, then let yourself put your attention someplace else. You know, let yourself go into nature, be nurtured by things that you know support you. And if you can, you know, meet that feeling without reactivity. If we can turn towards that feeling of, oh, okay, I'm feeling this pointlessness right now. Can I meet that feeling? We begin to see, again, that's a construct of our minds. The idea that things are pointless is simply an idea in our minds. When that idea disappears, there's no problem. There's just neutral experience arising, and then pleasant experience, and then unpleasant experience, and then neutral experience. So we start to see, again, how our own minds are doing, what our minds are doing, and begin to see the way through that. So the second question to just mention, does meditation lead to an escape attitude, or can meditation lead to an escape attitude? And if that happens, is that a wrong way of meditating? I think it's a very, normal in a way. I mean, in working with just this description that I said, you know, turning towards our suffering in this way, as we turn to meet our struggles and our suffering, we begin to see that turning towards eases things. We learn that, oh, I can be with unpleasant experience and not be reactive. We learn that we can be with difficult emotions, and there's space around it. And mindfulness brings like lubrication and ease to the picture, even in the midst of struggle. And this touches a little bit on your question, the third question. So it brings us to this place of seeing a little bit of spaciousness by bringing our mindfulness to it. It's like stepping outside of the way that we're caught, and able to just watch, again, like the car in neutral. We're able to just watch that unfold and dissipate, so that there's much more ease in our hearts and in our minds as we learn about this tool of meditation. And that leads us to want to meditate in order to get rid of these unpleasant experiences. It leads us to want to meditate in order to have a better day. It's very natural that this would happen. And we need to notice that this happens. We need to notice that we become attached to our meditation. We need to turn our mindfulness to that form of suffering. So it's very natural that when we see a tool or technique that helps us to alleviate suffering, that we then use, we turn that tool or technique into another wanting. Perfectly natural. It's like the way our minds work. And we just simply have to recognize, oh, I've started to do that again too. And again, it's not that we then say, oh, I've turned meditation into one of those tools, I need to forget about meditation. It's more that we open to the wanting around the meditation. We open to the sense of wanting to get rid of our suffering. And we see, actually, it's a fortunate situation in a way, because as soon as we want our meditation to get rid of our suffering, it doesn't work anymore. So it doesn't have that same kind of feedback loop of an addictive cycle, because as soon as we start wanting in our meditation, what we want doesn't come. So we then need to learn to recognize, okay, I'm wanting here. You know, again, open to that wanting. Just, can I be mindful of that wanting? And as the mind begins to let go and stop craving around that wanting, it sees the freedom in that. It gets the space around it. So, you know, sometimes there can be ways that people can, you know, find little islands in meditation too. You know, there can be times when we can find a place of I can just put everything else aside and just be with my breath. You know, I can just do that for a while. And in a way, that can lead to a kind of an escape from the world. And that, you know, that can serve you for a while. I've certainly noticed at the very beginning of my practice, anger was my big thing. And when I sat down in meditation, I didn't turn to face my anger. I just paid attention to my breath. And what a relief to not have my anger so in my face for a while. So it allowed me some space. So it allowed me to escape from my anger for a while. And seeing that, you know, the anger kept coming up in my daily life, my interest was, well, how can I bring this kind of sense of ease to that? So it can lead to an escapist attitude, but I think in most cases we end up navigating, you know, at times it's fine for us to use the meditation as a way to be relieved of our overwhelmed struggles. You know, sometimes when we can't turn to, when we turn to something that's very challenging for us, it overwhelms us, and it's very hard to be mindful. And so to find other tools, other ways that we can set that aside and just be with our breath for a while, or just be with sound, or just be at ease, is skillful. So navigating this, I think it can be helpful to talk to a teacher from time to time. It's like, you know, okay, am I, you know, avoiding these difficulties? You know, I think you'll find that if you're interested in really becoming free of suffering in your daily life, it won't be possible to escape it in your daily life in that way. It's possible to escape it by sitting down, closing your eyes, secluding yourself from everything out there. You can escape it for a while. And that can be very helpful. You know, it can be a place of respite for us. If we want to learn how to meet our lives with ease, that kind of escape, it doesn't really work. You know, it's not possible to, in the midst of life, I guess I will say it's probably not possible in the midst of life to navigate things if you're interested in exploring how we suffer in life, that exploration will begin to reveal to us the ways that we hold on, and the meditation or the mindfulness to create that space will be the very thing that gets in the way of that ease. So I think in a lot of ways the mindfulness practice has its own built-in safety mechanism around that escapism. The concentration practice we can escape into, but we can't really concentrate our way through our life. We have to be engaging. So if you're bringing mindfulness into your day, I think that will be. It won't be an ongoing issue if you're using mindfulness. Does that speak to you? Okay. So the third question of ease and peace in the terrain of struggle. So in what I've been talking about, all of this exploration around meeting our suffering, turning towards our suffering, we find that as we bring our mindfulness to our difficulties, that mindfulness brings with it a sense of well-being. As the mindfulness gets stronger, that even when we're in the midst of being with something really challenging, if we are present for it, there can be a sense even of joy, of being engaged with this difficulty. That as we see how this practice works, what we see is that the mindfulness and the wisdom of looking at our reactivity, and that's really one of the core pieces of wisdom that the Buddha said, notice your reactivity, turn towards it, don't just follow it, be with it. As we explore that, we see that those two pieces, that the mindfulness and the wisdom, give us more of a sense of ease and well-being right in the midst of our suffering. And we see, the thing that we start to see is that this exploration is the way towards well-being. That we get a visceral taste. It's not an idea. As we turn with mindfulness to our experience, we see, not with our eyes, but we feel in our being that this practice is giving us, is turning us in the direction of more and more happiness, more ease, more peace. And so we can, in the engagement with our struggles, our suffering, have a sense of rightness. And it's a sense of, this is the way, this, I mean, it's like there's not a struggle with that struggle anymore. It's like we've let go of the struggle around our struggle, and we see how we're heading towards more ease and more peace, that even with the struggle there can be a sense of ease and peace. And it does bring in that sense of compassion for ourselves. It's something I've seen in my own experience. There was one time it was just really clear to me. I was suffering over something, and the mind kept going back and going back to it. And there was something that felt really off in my experience. And initially, it was kind of like, oh, what is this feeling of off? I need to put this under the microscope. What is this? And then I realized, oh, let me just open to this. Allow this. Let me not try to fix it. Let me not try to escape this feeling of off. And what I found, actually, what that feeling of offness, when not resisted, was compassion. The heart opened when I stopped resisting that feeling that something's wrong, something's off, what's going on? When I stopped resisting that and trying to somehow get rid of it or fix it or escape it, it opened to, oh, compassion is here. And compassion has a sense of there's something off, there's something wrong, but it doesn't fight with that. It doesn't fight with what's wrong. It more allows and opens to that. And then also wants to take action to do something with that, to alleviate that suffering. And so this is the way action, I think in talking about what I've talked about today, you might get the idea that you're not supposed to, you know, all you're supposed to ever do is turn towards difficulty and never act. When we begin to touch into that compassion for our suffering, we see that the action can come out of that compassion instead of out of aversion or wanting. And that's a completely different way to navigate our lives, is from that place of compassion for suffering. And it does bring a peacefulness and ease that's present right with the suffering. That open heart, an open heart that can meet that struggle, meet that suffering. Not fight it, not resist it. So, three questions. It's 9 o'clock, so thank you for your questions. They worked together quite well, thank you. So I'll be away next week, but back the following week. And there will be somebody here next week, so thank you.